Have you ever felt that pang of disappointment when you couldn't add a ticket to your collection because it was digital? Or maybe you just lost it? Well, StubForge.com is here to change that. Imagine this: tickets that not only look but feel like the real deal. Because each ticket from StubForge is printed on the same quality stock that Ticketmaster uses and printed with genuine ticket printers. It's like holding a piece of the concert, the game, or the show right in your hands. But StubForge isn't just about replacing tickets. With the easy-to-use interactive designer, you can create custom tickets for anything, from concerts to sports games, pregnancy announcements, or parties. Why not make your invitations stand out with tickets that are as unique as your event? And if you're trying to complete a back catalogue of missing tickets, StubForge offers bulk discounts to make it both easy and affordable. With StubForge, you can once more give your loved ones physical tickets and see their eyes light up instantly at the best gift you can give. So whether you're looking to reignite your ticket collection, craft the perfect gift, or send the coolest invites, head over to StubForge.com. Start creating today and see how StubForge makes every ticket a story worth saving. Visit StubForge.com and start making tickets today.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
On this episode of the Bravery Academy, I talk with Josh van Kylenburg. Josh is a musician, podcaster, and a family guy. And you may have heard his voice on one of Australia's top podcasts, The Imperfects. Hosted alongside his brother Hugh and his friend Ryan Sheldon, they have taken mental health podcasts to a higher level. And it is my privilege to have this very much imperfect chat with this epic human, Josh van Kylenburg. Welcome, Josh, to the Bravery Academy. I'm really excited because I haven't mentioned this. Actually, I'm a bit of a fangirl, not just of The Imperfects. It's going to sound like a bit of a stalker, but my friends had actually were so excited to hear that you guys are coming on to the Bravery Academy because they were the six seats that I think you sold for the New Zealand show that you were going to be filming. Oh,
and they were going to go?
No, do not worry because they'll come to Australia for you. But I just had to say they were like so excited to hear that we're going to be coming in and hearing more about your story.
I'm honored to be here and honored to be asked. Not many people asked me to come on their podcast, so it's exciting.
Well, they should be because I think there's a lot to get to know.
We'll see.
So for people that don't know you, one of the reasons that I first found out about the beautiful work that you do and is from the podcast, The Imperfects. I'm obviously from the other side of the ditch in New Zealand, but this has been, from what I can see, a phenomenon in Australia, The Imperfects, now at top 0.1% of podcast creators. And
wow, did you not know that? I didn't know it was said. I haven't heard it said like that. That's a very exclusive number.
It is.
Very exciting.
It's very cool. Yeah. I'm only at 0.5 with my first podcast, so I'm pretty
won't take long.
Maybe. It's a bit of a crazy podcast, that one. So it's very different from what we're doing here. But okay. I've always been in awe of the work that you do. And I think one of the reasons why I really wanted to have you on here was your music. So I guess this is going to be something that kind of is a bit not what you're expecting.
Yeah.
But there was something that really stuck with me when you released your music video. And it must be, how many months ago is that now?
It would have been October last year. So I'm not good, as you know, being late for this recording myself. So I'm not good with numbers and times, but I'm going to guess 7 months, six months, about that. Yeah.
So I looked at the video of your brother and of Ryan watching the for the first time. And I had tears watching them. So I was straight away going, what is this? I have to watch this. And my daughter sat beside me, and if for people that haven't heard of Josh's beautiful music, We Were Here is the song. And I sat down and watched the video. So I really think people need to watch the video because that is just an outstanding storytelling and beauty, all with the music. And I'm not trying to fangirl you again, but it was just one of those moments where I was like, oh, this is really powerful and beautiful. And it's one of the reasons why I want to dig deeper into how you got there in the first place.
Absolutely. Let's go for it. I'm just curious, had you heard the song before seeing the video? Or was it that the first time you, oh, cool. I think that's probably the better way to experience it.
I think so too. So we'll make sure I put that in the show notes.
Awesome.
Straight away there. So tell me about where did you grow up? Where's lifestyle?
I grew up in Bourne, which is a suburb of eastern Melbourne, kind of leafy green. I think there's a song by what are they called? It's almost a piss take of a song by The Clash, but it's by the Skyhooks, Australian band called Bourne Calling, which is about kind of how boring it is. So it was beautiful. I absolutely loved it. But to give you an indication, it was sort of, it's in this weird pocket of Melbourne that was in about the 1920s, I think had a really highly religious group of people founding the suburb. And so it's actually a dry suburb. So there's no pubs or no license, or there wasn't when I was growing up, no like restaurant. It was BYO restaurants and no bottle shops or anything like that. Oh, there were bottle shops, sorry, but no licensed venues. And so as a like growing up, it was a really safe, green, warm, lovely environment and a really happy early childhood. But it was frustrating when I turned 18 and wanted to go to pubs and you had to drive like, or get a cab like three suburbs to get to a pub. So it meant cab fares were a bit expensive when I didn't have much money.
And what was life like with a brother like you? So if you really haven't listened to The Imperfects, obviously there is you, there is Hugh, your brother, and then there's Ryan as well in there. But you've obviously, Hugh's the older brother, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. So Hugh, there's three siblings. Ryan's not one of the siblings, to be clear. There's older brother Hugh, who's 6 years older than me, and then sister Georgia, who's 3 years older than me in the middle. And I was the luckiest little brother around, I think. I had two older siblings who, I think it's okay, this doesn't sound arrogant, I don't think, but they just adored me. They were so warm and loving and caring. And childhood was, I have no, like, we're an odd family in that I can't remember ever having an argument, either physical or even verbal, with either of my siblings in my whole life. And certainly not growing up. I threw a tennis ball at Hugh a bit hard once and hit him in the back and he got annoyed at me. And that is basically the peak of conflict as kids. We actually grew up in this house that was like a really long, really big block. The woman who owned before us was an Olympic swimmer in the 30s and she had like a lap pool put in the back. So we had this abnormally large, like 15, 20 meter long lap pool in our backyard. So my memories of growing up are basically summer around in and around that pool, playing games and all sorts of things and just so much fun, so much happiness.
So you share so much in the podcast though where it didn't always feel happy in regards to later in life and the challenges that you went through. There was
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's all kind of pre-teen years. So teen years is where it got a bit tough. So my sister was diagnosed with an eating disorder in her teenage years. And as anyone who's had any kind of mental ill health like that visit the family and has a huge gravitational pull on the entire family. And so from there on, it was a bit of a, because I was, I'm going to get these dates wrong because I think, as you probably know, the way trauma and all that kind of stuff works, it gets very muddy with timing. But I think I was probably about 11 or 12 when she was diagnosed, or at least when things were serious, but that could be around about that time. So I was sort of transitioning into what's, how would you say it, slightly challenging time in your life regardless when you're going into high school, going through puberty, all that kind of stuff. But then also having the added layer of us as a family trying to navigate something that was terrifying and really sad. Sad's an understatement. It was really tragic. Going through that on top of just going through puberty and teenage years was challenging. So I think my self-identity started to go on a bit of a skewed path from there.
How did that skew? Which way did it go?
Well, for me, I tried to make everyone feel like everything's okay. I think we all did, really. Like Georgia is the most resilient, toughest person I think I've ever met. And so she was battling a terrible mental illness by, well, not by herself, but she was dealing with it in the best way she could. And Hugh was trying to make everyone laugh and keep everyone happy. And I was trying to be perfect, really, and make sure that I got perfect marks, never did anything wrong at school. We do, part of the live show, that we've been touring around the country, we do these tea house cards that we've got on our podcast. And I pulled one the other day in a live show where I found myself telling this story about being a teenager, and that I got threatened with a detention once, and I got looked so upset that they pulled it off. They took it back.
Yeah, they're like, "Oh, sorry, mate. Sorry."
They're like, "Oh God, we can't give this kid a detention. He's too upset." So I kind of tried to be perfect. I was like, again, this isn't bragging. I think this is more just to give you an indication of the kind of student I was. I was like a middle school captain, and at our school, there was like middle school and then senior school breaking up. And it was like middle school captain was pretty good, but what you really wanted was senior school, like the full school captain. And I come from a strange family in that my uncle, cousin, dad, nephew now, and brother were all school captains. And so there was this pressure on me and my sister was middle school captain, and there's pressure on me to be like, all right, I've got to do that. And so when I didn't get that, it was like a failure. It was a failure that my friends still sort of tease me about to this day because they know it gets to me. But because of that, they're aware of how silly it is to hold on to that kind of thing. But for me at the time, it was like, that was another thing where I have to be perfect to make sure everything's okay and everyone's sort of, I guess, proud of me to a degree, but also that give a bit of a shining light to what was quite a dark time for us. Yeah. So perfectionism has been a big thread, which is ironic because when Hugh, I'm 99% sure it was Hugh that came up with the name of Perfects, but I feel like I should be sure of that before putting it out there in the world. Perfectionism, it hadn't occurred to me how much of a strong thread that was in my life because I think because I saw how imperfectly I do everything, it was real blind spot on me to not realize that me focusing on all my imperfections all the time is an indication that I'm probably a bit of a perfectionist.
How did that show up then?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sort of jumping around a bit here because it going more into 20s, but nothing I ever did was really good enough. I've talked about this with a few people close to me who think in a similar way, friends and stuff like that. And I think this is common for people who are trying to create stuff that has an element of creativity, in that I would work at something, this is in my mid-20s now, work at something and create it regardless of the quality of the work. Probably have sort of 2 or 3 seconds of going, that feels good, before all these demons would start jumping in and saying all the things that were wrong with it and why it's not good and this really negative self. And then it just spirals from there about, like, not only is that work good, but you're no good. This is proof that you're not actually creative. You're never going to make it. You're whatever making it was in my mind then. But you're not one of the talented ones. You're not one of the ones that makes it pretty quickly. So there was a real jump. Being able to separate the work from who I was impossible for a very, very long time.
And that was work in your career. So, you know, leaving school and going to uni, that thread just kept coming through all the way through into even now?
Yeah, not so much now. It's gone really now, which maybe we can explore why later. Well, I don't know if it's ever gone, but I feel like I've got it in a healthy spot now. It was anything creative, so music and work. Music was never really work. And I guess it sort of is now, but it doesn't really feel like it at all. But it never really was. So it was sort of the creative stuff outside of work and then work itself. Yeah, I've been lucky that I've had the same partner, Sophie, since I was 20. We met when I was 21, but we didn't sort of start seeing each other till I was about 23. But we've been together since then. And I'm really lucky that now wife and mother of our kids is the most incredible person. So I've been really lucky that for the majority of my adult life, I've had an incredible relationship, and really good friends as well. But everything outside of that always felt like a bit of a failure.
So what did you do at university?
I studied media communications and majored in filmmaking. And I mean, there's a good example that I went to school with an incredible filmmaker, an incredible filmmaker called Corey Chen, who's doing amazing things in Australia at the moment. And a guy called Lewis Hobber, who has been on our podcast, and he's a radio presenter who was one of my best friends at uni. And it was a reasonably difficult in the space of media and film to get into this course. So it had a bit of a alumni of people, like the guys who made the Saw franchise went there a few years earlier. And there was like a, it was sort of like a high-ish achieving, it was a high-achieving film degree to a degree, so to speak. But on the first lecture we got, the woman who was running the lecture said, well done for getting in. Media industry dying. There are no jobs in media. So you're not going to get a job anyway, which is the most soul-destroying start to a career. So I kind of didn't really make the most of uni. It's like a classic uni student in that I partied and drank a lot and had a lot of fun and made good friends and really enjoyed my time. But weirdly, the perfectionism completely disappeared once I finished school. So I got like, as far as uni work went, like it's kind of strange when I think about it now for someone who held onto it so tightly at school. And then afterwards when I was working and felt like a failure because I wasn't doing well enough, that at uni I allowed myself a few years of just sort of getting just good enough to pass grades for that. And I got through and passed, but it would be a literal, I'm sure, I don't know what it says, but it would be like pass on the certificate and nothing higher than that. I think it was sort of, I was exhausted from school trying so hard, and I was kind of discovered drinking and how much fun I could have. And I think it was me starting to find out who I actually really was through that process. But then it was just, but that failure at uni, failure to make the most of that opportunity meant that in hindsight, I would look back and see people like Lewis and Curry, who I spoke about before, and many others who have gone on to do great things. I would look at them and go, oh, they made the most of their opportunity and you're a failure for not doing that. Maybe you would be actually successful now if you took that seriously, sort of thing. It's easy to, a negative voice is pretty easy for me to fight.
Yeah. What were you taught about success then growing up?
Really good question. I don't really know if I've got a very profound answer. Mum and Dad are incredibly supportive and loving. Like I was never pushed into applying for things like school captains and high achieving stuff. They were always very, very good at telling me that I was enough just being myself and I didn't need to do that kind of stuff. So I never really felt like the messaging of perfectionism came from them. However, they do have standards of like that you need to make the most of your opportunities. I think the fact that I went to a private school and we were not necessarily, well, like we were wealthy enough, mum and dad were wealthy enough. Like dad was a dentist, mum was a librarian at the private school. So wealthy enough to send their kids there, but that was kind of where the money went and there wasn't a lot left after that, as opposed to kids at those schools who are just so wealthy it beggars belief. So there, I think with that comes a certain expectation that they're sacrificing a lot for you to be there. So, and it was never said ever, to be clear. And I think they'd probably want to avoid me ever thinking this, but I think you notice it and you take it on. And I think you take it on as a sort of thing of pride to a degree as well. Yeah. So success was, I think there's a realism in my family from my parents that you can't really control the outcome, but you don't waste the opportunity. Yeah. Make sure you work hard and give it your best shot. I think the real fear would have been getting to the end of, as I have a recurring dream now, and I'm sure everyone does, of getting to like year 12 exams or whatever and not having done enough study to be ready would have been mortifying and really a disappointment, I think. Yeah.
Interesting. I can see my son in this kind of mentality too of that.
Proving.
Yeah. He's 13 and worked the butt off and is very interesting. Yeah. I'm like, he's not, you know, the thought of getting attention for him is also like his nightmare. He's like, oh, this won't happen, mum. And I look at it and I'm like, how do I also let you know that it's okay to have those moments of failure as well?
Mm.
Because I've definitely failed. I've failed massively in some big public ways. And it's like, okay. Well, how do I teach them that? So what have you learned from failure then over the years after that?
Oh, that it's really good. it's one of the most important things, I think. And the way that you could frame it and deal with it is, it feels to me like one of the most important things to learn in life and something I'm trying to get better at, to almost see them as not something to look forward to, because they're always awful when you fail, especially when it's public, but it's not all bad. Like there's some good, really, really good stuff that can come out of this, and growth and learning. And it's kind of the only way if you do it well, the only way you can really have, I think quick, big improvement on whatever you're trying to improve in whatever aspect of life. I should probably also add to that, the success thing, I think, was also heavily framed by the fact that my brother and sister were incredibly successful at school and had an identity that was well known. So there was sort of like this thing of like, oh, there's another one of those two coming through. What are you going to be excellent at?
Well, yeah, because that wasn't there.
Yeah, heaps. Yeah, so much. Because they were both in their own, and some overlap, but in their own areas. So there was, yeah, like, what's going to be your thing? And I think people, especially in a school system like that, try and automatically go, are you going to be your sister or are you going to be your brother?
Yeah.
So it's very hard to carve out your own path in that, in a world where you've had two big personalities who are very good at what they do ahead of you.
So how do you feel like the DC of Josh has come through then in these 30 plus years, you know?
Well, I mean, it's been something I've been working on in my own time and probably made a few missteps along the way in getting lost. And there was a beautiful, it's weird to reference our own show, but it's a guest on our show, Bronte Campbell. I don't know if you listened to that episode. Yeah, she was brilliant. And she has this incredible analogy where she talks about how, because just, I mean, exceptional siblings, she's to a whole new degree for anyone that's listening that doesn't know her sister, Kate, is one of the greatest swimmers of all time. So is Bronte, but she just happens to be like the second best behind her sister. I can't remember the exact details, but it's something like at a point in time, the only person that ever swam faster than her in history was her sister. And they're best friends and love each other. But she was talking about how she has an analogy of going bush bashing, and that it's like she's been following her sister bush bashing the whole time. And then she had to cut off her own path and start bashing away at her own path to find her own way. And that's difficult and challenging. And her sister didn't necessarily notice that she was going off her own path. And that caused for them a bit of confusion of like, why are you no longer right behind me? But it was a necessary step. So I think throughout my 20s, there's a lot of bush bashing and sometimes exciting, often exciting, but also I don't know if I could have done it any other way than what I did, but I don't think I felt like myself until, for me, that I had kids and had this podcast, those two things.
I don't think being a dad changed that for you.
Well, I did a lot of work with a psychologist leading up to it, and it wasn't leading up to it for the purpose of having kids. It was just because I was in such a low place, I needed help. So I saw an incredible psychologist for about 6 years, I reckon. And I had this amazing session about 2 or 3 weeks before my first child was born. That was like quite a profound thing. It was almost like it felt like we'd been leading up to this for 6 years. For some people, well, I know it takes longer to have a bond with your child, but for me, it was like immediate. It was this like lightning bolt, bigger than a light bulb, lightning bolt kind of moment, seeing Charlie for the first time. And I can't remember, it probably wasn't right then, but I remember starting to get negative thoughts about myself after the euphoria of having a child wore off and just sort of saying to myself, your child deserves better than this, than a dad that'll talk about himself like this, because the last thing I want is him to think that. So I'm emotional about it. I didn't want to continue being that because I thought he deserved a better role model, and that worked for me. And they're still there sometimes, but I'm able to snap out of it. And I think just the general euphoria of raising a child, it's an absolute roller coaster. But the highs are so high that, and I get so many of them, that it sort of keeps me feeling pretty great a lot of the time, even if I am on 5 hours of interrupted sleep like I am right now.
Firing all cylinders. So Charlie was a circuit breaker for those thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah, Charlie, and I think it's important to talk about the amount of work I did leading up to that as well. But yeah, I think it was a circuit breaker. That was a second jolt after that amazing session before the birth. Yeah.
I think that's really powerful for men, first of all, to hear, but anybody to hear about that fact that you've done so much work stepping into that inquiry, that psychology inquiry about yourself, that what did it feel like when you first stepped into that space?
Going to a therapist or psychologist? Yeah. Well, I guess I was familiar with the value of them probably earlier than most males in my generation. because of what my sister had gone through. And she'd seen a psychiatrist and psychologist a lot, and we'd had some family psychology sessions. So when I was struggling, started to struggle at about 19 or 20, I told my parents and they recommended, someone I knew was seeing a psychiatrist, even though I probably didn't need a psychiatrist, but it was like bulk billed. So as a 19-year-old, I could do it for free. So I was like, great, I'll go there. And that was okay. And it was an okay window, but he wasn't the right fit for me. And some of the things he said, and now I'm kind of mind blown that he's, to be honest. Like, I'd broken up with my first ever proper girlfriend and wanted to write a letter to her saying basically thank you and for the person that I am now because of you, not trying to any agenda, just we probably, because she lives now, I assume, in Perth, so the other side of Australia. So like, I know we'll never see each other again, but just a thank you, basically.
Gratitude letter.
I guess it was before I knew what they were. Yeah. And I read it to him in a session and his response was, geez, you really wear your heart on your sleeve, don't you? And kind of ridicule me. Yeah. But I still sent it to her because I was like, even then I'm like, I think you're wrong. I think I need to send this. So he wasn't right for me. And then I, about 4 or 5 years later, I saw another psych who, she was lovely, but again, it just wasn't the right fit. Nothing against her, but it just didn't feel right. And then I had my first and only really serious panic attack when I was probably 25. And my brother knew this psychologist and he recommended, who he'd known through work, the work he was doing, and suggested her because he thought we'd be a good match from a personality basis. And from the moment I met her, it was like, yeah, this is the person I need as my psychologist. And it was a really good fit and an amazing 6 years. And I haven't seen her since. Yeah. And I did do one session after birth, but it was after the birth. But it almost felt, I don't think we need this anymore. It was a kind of nice session of, yeah, this is done. And I'm really excited that we're going to have, because she's extremely by the book and I haven't seen her for 4 years, it allowed her the freedom to, because she's doing incredible work now in Australia and she's going to do an episode of the podcast with us later in the year.
Oh, exciting.
So that's coming up. We've recorded it and it was such an amazing chat and that'll come out later in the year, which is really cool. Yeah, but it's not about me because that would be very unethical. So it's about the work she's doing now in resilience and helping people. Yeah.
Love that. But I also do love when you have episodes and suddenly you're like, well, I don't want to make it about me, but I'm going to make it.
Yeah, I'll probably do that too much.
And then like Ryan's like, no, I want to make it about me. Like, that's a bit off kilter.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got to. Yeah, I'm glad you like it, but I was thinking grossly. I've got to stop making it about me. Really do.
Those are the moments where everybody like leans in and go, what's he going to say?
What's he going to share?
What's the share going to be? Yeah.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
What about the music then? Tell me about the music, because I know you've had bands, you've had two bands and you've sort of explored that. What was then the catalyst to actually write and perform your song?
So I'd played music since I was about 12. So during my teenage years, the thing I probably enjoyed the most was playing music. I played sport and music, but singing and playing guitar. And then I never really tried to write music. So I've recently released music, but to explain why I have to go back in time. So when I was sort of, it was older than 20, I was with Soph, so it must have been 23. We just started dating. She invited me to this party actually, she thought it was a fancy dress party. So I dressed up and went along, and it wasn't fancy.
What did you go as?
Amazingly, it was a really like hipster art scene, like crowd from like art school. And I kind of went, I can't remember what the theme was, but I went as like a kind of 1950s James Dean kind of rocker thing. And they just thought that was my style. And they were like, oh, it's cool, man. And so I kind of got away with one and just blended in. But I had my dad's old leather jacket on that was like a 60s leather jacket. And it was an amazing thing with these. Actually, it must have been 70s because it had enormous collars on it. Anyway, I hadn't realized, but I had a little notepad in my breast pocket, and the notepad had some lyrics that I've been trying to write. And I was standing around a fire out the back of this house having a drink, and this guy grabbed the notepad out of my pocket, just like grabbed it. I didn't know anyone at this party except for Soph and one and her friend. And he grabbed it and just started reading it, going, oh, what's this? And I panicked and I said, oh, I've got no idea. This is my mate's jacket, and just lied because I was terrified. And he was like, oh, I think these are song lyrics. These are amazing. And started like reading them out loud. And then the notepad got passed around the circle and everyone took the piss out of the song that I was trying to write. And I was even so trying to cover it up and mortified, and that it came to me and I read out my own lyrics, taking the piss out of them to people in the circle. And so from that day on, I kind of never tried, I never really tried to write lyrics again. I wrote musical parts in bands that I was in and sort of helped with lyrics a little bit, like I'd make little suggestions, but I would never, and certainly in the first band, I didn't want to write lyrics. I wrote the instrumental stuff. In the second band, yeah, I helped a little bit with the odd line, but I could never sit down and actually write a song. And as I got older and older, it really started to irk me that I was kind of a minorly traumatized by this experience and couldn't sit down and sort of have this writer's block for 12 years, 13 years. And I told this story on the podcast. And then we were coming up with what we're going to do for the live show that we've been touring. And one of the guys, either Ryan, Hugh or Bridget, I can't remember, said, it would be incredible if we finished the show with you performing a song. And at the time I was like, oh yeah, great. I'll do like Hallelujah by Jeff Buckley or something. And they were like, no, no. The idea is that I think it would be much more powerful if you felt comfortable writing a song.
Wow.
And performing it as like an act of vulnerability. And I was like, that is a really, can I swear?
Yeah, fuck yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's a really fucking good idea. And we had gone away to a house for the weekend to write the show, and I was in such a good mood that I was like, that is so exciting. I think I'm ready. Let's do it.
Wow.
I'm a dad now. I've gone through that transition I've talked about before where I'm not as down on myself, not as negative. I want to do this. And then a few months went by. This is probably 6 months, 8 months before we had to perform the show. And I'm like, I'll do it. I'll definitely do it. And then I kind of have a bit of a thing about guitars where I feel like there's a song in a guitar or in a musical instrument. Like there's just a thing that when you pick up, well, for me, when I pick up an instrument, I automatically start playing a certain type of music depending on how it feels and how the instrument sounds. And so I thought, what I need is a new guitar, nothing fancy, nothing expensive, but I want to get like a crappy, in inverted commas, acoustic guitar that's a bit quirky and a bit weird, but actually really is full of character. And there's a guitar shop about 100 meters from our office. And the guy Jeremy there is a great guy. And I went in there and I was describing this to him. I'm like, I just need something. And I don't want to spend much, like 250, 300 bucks max on this guitar. Something like, and I just point on the wall, like that one there, that was pretty weird. And he's like, that one is 250 and it's unbelievable. It's like weird as anything. It's got like a hole in the wrong place. It's all broken and it's going to be perfect, which I was like, that's great. And he's like, and it sounds brilliant. So I picked it up and it was like smaller than a normal guitar, which I really liked as well. And it was perfect. It was the exact guitar I was after. So I bought that, started writing the song. And I was like, I had this routine where at night, try and write when the kids are in bed for an hour, just to try and get some hours under my belt, mainly music at this point. I still couldn't bring myself to tackle lyrics. And then the guitar got stolen.
What?
Someone stole it. Yeah. I left it in the car out the front of our house and someone broke into the car and stole the guitar. Yeah.
Did the song go with that or did the new song come through?
Well, I think there were other songs that I'd written with that guitar that I think I have recordings of that I might try and turn into something one day. But the, at that point, I was like, oh, no, this is a sign or something. And I got a bit down and I just didn't touch it for another few months. And then it was like, it's like a month out from the show and I didn't have anything. And my wife was like starting to panic because she's much more organized and onto things and get stuff done. I was also feeling bad taking away time for the kids to write a song. It's such an amorphous thing that takes a lot of time. I was like, I felt guilty just sitting there and coming back and Soph going, so how was it? Me going, I don't know, got nothing. She's like, okay, that's good. I've had the kids for 6 hours. You got nothing. Yeah, but I started writing a few lyrics and going back and I read this incredible, there's an incredible podcast with Jerry Seinfeld and Tim Ferriss where he talks about writing. And it's one of the best pieces of advice for writing I've ever heard, where you sit down and write for the set period of time that you said you were going to do it and then shut it and don't look back on anything you've written and tell yourself you're a genius for a day and that everything's amazing and walk around with the feeling that everything you did was great.
Oh my God.
And don't look back on it. And then after 24 hours, come back and go through it with your critical brain. And he's like, I'm lucky if I keep 1%. But if I don't give myself 24 hours thinking I'm good, then I'll spend my entire writing life thinking I'm terrible because the critical brain will come in straight away. And it's true that 99% of what you write is no good, but you can't think about yourself 99% of the time as a bad writer or you'll never write, which I thought was amazing advice. So did that. And then it was honestly, it was like 2 weeks out from the show and I still didn't have anything. And I was like, I've just got to go into the office and stay there. And I actually did it at the podcast table that we record at with another guitar and a couple of ideas I had and kind of pulled it together. And I stayed there till like 2 a.m. just trying to do it. And there's a moment where I haven't actually told anyone this. I might have told Hugh and Ryan, but there's a line in the song that I hadn't written and hadn't popped into my head. And I sung it as I was playing that part of the song. It just popped into my head and I started like bawling. And the line is this line, one day I'll hold you for the last time. I hope I have something good in your life because you're the best thing in mine. And it like, I just started crying and bawling. And it was at that point where I'm like, okay, it was a really out of body experience. And this is such a rambly story, but there was a point in here where I had written terrible lyrics. They're like objectionably not good. And I was like looking back at him going, these are so shit. And I called Ryan to talk to him about it because I really respect Ryan and for writing. Obviously, he's one of my closest friends, but he's also a great writer. And he was like, you've got to put this shit out there to get to the good stuff. He's like, that's just part of the process. So don't go be down yourself. And for me, getting to that one lyric and some other stuff in there as well that I quite like, it was the first time I'd ever pushed through lots of stuff that was actually no good and got to the other side where good came out of it. And I realized I saw the full process and I felt this amazing buzz of confidence of like, oh, you can, if you push through the crap, there is actually good stuff on the other side, but you've just got to not hate yourself enough and just be objectionable and say, okay, the work's not good, but you're okay. You just keep going. That you might come up with something that you're proud of at the end. And at that point, because it meant so much to me and it made me cry, it didn't really matter anymore what other people thought of it. I was like, I'm confident to sing this to someone and perform this because it's a truth within me that represents exactly how I feel. And the feeling came out on the paper. And that's success. And to go back on some stuff I said earlier, it's anything past that I can't control. So it can't be really defined as success. So I've got there and this is enough. Yeah.
What would it feel like when Hugh listened to it and watched it?
Well, that was pretty, that was pretty good. I mean, Hugh had heard the song at that point. I'll never forget the first time I played the song for the guys. So I didn't play any of it to them until it was actually pretty ballsy, come to think of it. But we had our first show to like 1,000 people in Geelong on the Saturday night. We had two shows back to back and we had rehearsals that week and no one had heard the song.
Oh my God.
Until Wednesday of that week. And we had a rehearsal booked and I think even Bridge and Ryan, even though they were keeping it very cool, they're like, it's okay. It'll come when it's ready. Cause I think that happened on like, it was less than 10 days, I think, before the first show that I got that song, that moment. And so they were like, full confidence, it'll happen. Don't worry, we're not pushing you. But I think on the inside, they'd be like going, oh shit, we might have to rewrite the end of the show. And then we had a full rehearsal on the Wednesday, which we'd done heaps. And we got to that point of the show where I played the song and I was like, I think I'm going to play it. I'm ready to play it. And they're like, yes, so I played it. And Hugh bawled the first time he heard it. And I'll never forget watching him over in the Connemara playing for the first time and him properly bawling. And that was a pretty incredible moment and pretty special. Yeah. And then the film clip thing that you're referring to is equally as special, but in a different way. He was crying about different things.
Yeah.
At that point, as we've talked about afterwards, the thought, I think, does he say this on the episode? Did he say this afterwards? I can't remember, but the thought process for him in that was, as you'll see the film clip, not when you're much away, was the thought, what of me being gone and him still alive one day, was that the possibility that I might get old and die and he'll still be alive, which could happen, might not, but that's what really, it sort of struck him that was a chance of happening. Yeah.
That's kept come through in some of the conversations. Obviously, it sounds like I'm very much an Imperfects fan, but I could hear that in moments where you have interviewed guests. I think that might have been the James Clear one recently that came out.
Mm.
And Hugh's want, like you said, you were surrounded by love growing up, but that love and that wanting for you to be here and to be healthy keeps coming through. How does that feel to you hearing that?
Oh, it's a bit overwhelming, actually. Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, as I've said, the love coming from my siblings and my family is pretty intense. I'm extremely lucky to have that kind of love. But it's also overwhelming because it takes you into a place of, I think the dying and leaving other people, the dying part, I'm working really hard to come to terms with. Already, I feel like it's something I should deal with pretty early in life because I think it'll lead to a much better life. And here I am plugging our show again, but we've got an episode coming out this year with Bronnie Ware,
who is the author of Bronnie's work. Amazing.
Yeah, which was a really profound episode where we go into this a little bit. And I might have said this in the show, but there's a quote from one of my favorite writers, Christopher Hitchens, who says when his first child was born, he said it was like he saw the funeral director at his funeral walking onto the stage, sort of saying, you're next thing. And I felt something very similar when Charlie was born, but not in a terrifying way. It was in a really healing, soothing way. A you're next in a very caring, loving way, but also the effect it had is that it helped me with that voice as well of going, okay, well, and there's a lyric in a song about this that I don't have much time, which was misinterpreted by some people I know who thought I was sick, unfortunately, which I didn't mean. I didn't mean for that to come across, but it's more that I don't have much time left and I don't want to waste any of it thinking that I'm thinking negative thoughts about myself. And so this is a roundabout way of saying, yes, Hugh's concerned for my health. Yeah, it's overwhelming because it's a hard thing to tackle because I've never been great at diet and exercise or the things that will prolong your life. So it's hard to hear it laced in those terms because it feels like, how could you not do it if someone loves you and cares about you that much? But I've also got kids and a wife who I would think don't want to rock you, Hugh. But I reckon they might even love me more. So I think I owe it to them just as much to get fit. And it's something I really want to do is to get healthier. But it's also really tricky when you've got a 2-year-old who doesn't sleep and you're time poor and it's difficult. So even though I feel like I might have the mental capacity to treat my body with a bit more care and respect, the time and energy just isn't quite there at the moment. But I'm looking forward to it maybe one day. Yeah.
I think there's also those chapters of life that we have. And sometimes, and like I said to you, my kids are a lot older than yours. And it took to them to be that kind of 5 to 6 years old to be like, oh, now I can breathe a little bit easier. There's more capacity. They need me, but they don't need me as much. And then it's this next stage now. And I'm like, oh gosh, I can train every day. I couldn't do that when they were younger. Like, I don't know how people do that when they're younger.
Yeah.
Like, it's just hats off to them. that my energy was put into somewhere else. And like you said, that lack of sleep. But I think that's that compassion that we've got to have as parents sometimes to be like, we actually can't do it all, I mean, especially when you're working and you're running around doing all the different things.
Oh, it's so hard. I think it's not spoken about enough because there's so much pressure to be able to do it all. I think it's not mentioned enough to like give yourself a break on certain aspects of your life when you're raising kids. I'm certainly bad at that. I put a lot of pressure on many parts of my life. But on the good days, I'm able to remind myself that it's just like, you've got to be going on. It's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah. But I think with anything, like Hugh is one of those people that is able to maintain this incredible exercise regime whilst having three kids. But I think that's because it's something he loves to do before having kids.
Yeah.
So it's his happy time. Whereas at the moment, like playing music is my happy time, but I don't have time for that either. Like I play music to prepare for these live shows, but I haven't been able to write anything since then. I've got a few ideas of things that I'd love to pursue and try and write more music. And it was it's an incredible opportunity to release music to people who might want to listen to it at the moment. But it's a timely thing, time consuming thing. And I don't really have the time to sit there for 3 or 4 hours and see what happens.
Because, priorities.
Yeah, because I also care too much about being a, I don't want this to come out the wrong way for other people. But for me personally, I care so much about being a present dad and a good partner that I don't want to take away from that by writing music by myself, which is kind of a paradox because I feel like it's the first time in my life where I have something to say, but I don't think now's the time to say it. But maybe it will be when one of them starts sleeping better. Yeah, who knows?
I think it's really beautiful actually hearing that from a man that values around family and commitment. Good friend of mine who recently single said to me, how do we find more emotionally available people just like men like you out there? Because this is kind of what I want to see more of. Like, I'll check in with Josh and find out how do we create.
I know one. I know a single one, actually. He's a great guy.
Great. We'll hook them up later.
Yeah, definitely.
Cross the ditch.
Yeah, without a doubt.
But that's kind of the beauty of what I feel like, and we haven't even talked about the Imperfect. So if anybody is wanting to hear what you guys do, that the collaboration and the team and that you have, and what the whole process of the Imperfect is quite a unique product and unique podcast to be listening to. And I think that comes from the three of you. And so if people haven't listened to it, I really recommend actually jumping on and starting at the beginning, because there's actually so much to take in. Hearing the development of all three of you along this way. And I think there's one thing that I remember listening to, it's maybe probably there was like a few months into it, where you would be like, I don't know if I'm supposed to be in this room. I don't know if I'm supposed to be in this podcast with these two exceptional humans, Ryan with his background, with everything, and your brother Hugh, with all those layers. How do you feel about that now, all these years now on the track?
I think I feel like I should be there now. It took a long time. But I really didn't feel like it. And it was a wavering thing. Like some days I'd feel, but it was very much performance-based. I felt like if I felt like I contributed to an interview, I'd be like, oh no, you are deserving of being here. But if for whatever reason I wasn't able to contribute much to an interview, it would be like, oh yeah, see, this is proof that you shouldn't be here and you fluked it last time. But I think now I've gotten to a point where I realize that we can't always be great every time we do something. And just because you might have an off day, doesn't mean you shouldn't be there. And also, I'm really lucky to have the team we've got. I should also add to that
Bridget,
who is just incredible and so much of the personality of the show, more than the personality, but she really is the fourth leg of that table that creates the feeling and the themes and the episodes. And we've also got an incredible editor, George and Jam, who edit episodes and work on stuff with her. And Dr. M as well, who's just a phenomenon.
Yes.
But as far as creating the sort of DNA of the show, it's very much the four of us. But I'm lucky that it's such an incredibly supportive, open, it's the best working relationship I've ever had. It's incredible. I think the openness that you hear on the show, we've made sure that we have taken off the mics as well. So everything is very caring and open, and there's nothing you can really not say if you're feeling certain things. It's better set out with compassion and care. and dealt with compassion and care, sorry, which makes for an incredible group to work with. They're really, yeah, my closest friends. That sounds bad because I've got other friends who are just as close, but we're all really close friends as well, which is really special.
You covered yourself. You've got lots of friends.
Yeah. Not that many, but they're all,
They're really special.
Others that are as close that I don't want to feel like I'm pushing away from that statement. There's an analogy that Hamish Blake said on our show that worked for me with this, which I think people should take into anything that they feel like they shouldn't be there. Because I said to him, I feel like I'm only on this show because I'm Hugh's brother. And he said, well, who cares? He's like, I'm going to paraphrase it. He did it better than me. But he's like, you're here and you're doing the job. And from an objective, just like watching it as it's happening, you don't seem like you shouldn't be here. You're contributing the way you're meant to contribute. And you saying that you're only here because you're Hugh's brother is like someone saying, seeing a car crash and walking past seeing a car crash and saving someone's life and people saying, well, you're not a hero. You're just going to be walking past.
Yeah.
Which is such a great analogy for imposter syndrome, I think.
It is. He had a great episode with you. And I think that's a big thing with so many people struggling with imposter syndrome. Hearing it from people that have shown up in such a brave way it's really powerful.
Yeah, absolutely.
My last question for you, though, is around bravery. And when I messaged you earlier, you were like, well, I don't think I'm brave. I'm like,
yeah.
What do you think bravery is then?
I really should have known. I should have known this question. Come and consider that you sent me the question if I think I'm brave, because I'm not sure I have a great answer for it. Because I think I would take issue at a sort of traditional definition of bravery, which to me, I think probably as a male growing up in sort of inhaling the idea of bravery there, I have issue with, which is a very sort of macho bravery.
Yeah.
Which I don't necessarily identify with or think is very useful or valuable. So thinking of times where I've been brave, I think I always think of other people who are braver and deal with a lot tougher, harder things every day and are able to still hold on to who they are throughout all that. Being able to hold on to the person that you are and the best version of yourself through difficulty and when you don't know what the outcome's going to be, maybe that is somewhat brave.
That feels lovely.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if that's it, but it's something.
Kind of full circle for what we've been talking about today. An imperfect chat about how we grow through life and how we have challenges and definitely the ways that you step into it. And I think you've been a role model in so many ways for men out there and women. And I haven't even talked about, there's so many bits I would want to talk to you about. You've been doing some really brave things actually on the podcast, I would have said, even with the recent chat about men. And I hat off to you that the way that you are stepping into things that are uncomfortable. Please keep doing it. Please keep doing it. People are listening. And it is amazing to sort of see that kind of ripple effect out. And that's the kind of leadership that we need in the world. So thank you, Josh, for jumping on.
Oh, thank you. You've used a lot of words I don't identify myself as, but I'm very flattered. And yeah, there's no plan in stopping anytime soon.
Amazing. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Great.
Thank you for tuning into the Bravery Academy. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button. And if you're looking to take your support for the podcast to the next level, visit patreon.com/thebraveryacademy to access exclusive content and get early access to our upcoming episodes. Your feedback means the world to us. So please take a moment to give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for being part of the Bravery Academy community. Stay brave, stay curious, and keep challenging yourself to grow. Until next time.
Hi there. I'm Heather Drago.
And I'm Sarah Saunders.
We host the podcast, That's a Hard No, about saying no and setting boundaries.
So you can become that true and empowered you that this world needs. Saying no isn't just okay.
It's the key to living an authentic, fulfilling life.
I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor, so while this podcast is in no way a replacement for one-on-one therapy, I suppose I know what I'm talking about.
I'd say so. We talk about learning to say no and set healthy boundaries and how it impacts mental health, physical health, relationships, parenthood, and more.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit our website, hardknowpodcast.com.
We're here to help you find your no and say it unapologetically.
That's a hard no.
Our lives were never the same after we learned our 21-year-old daughter, Kristen, was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. It's a parent's worst nightmare. How much did we really know about domestic violence back then? Clearly not enough. Now we know plenty. We know domestic violence, or DV, can happen to anyone. 1 in 3 women suffer physical violence at the hands of intimate partners during their lifetimes. 1 in 3. I'm Bill Mitchell, host of the When Dating Hurts podcast. And my interviews with DV counselors, law enforcement, and especially actual DV survivors give the pandemic of domestic violence the attention it deserves. The When Dating Hurts podcast. It's a series of lives being saved.
Welcome to Easy Conversations, a podcast about covering the incredible human ability to overcoming adversity. I am Furkan Dandiga. I'm a therapist and mental health advocate. Each week, my objective is to sit down with a guest and share their story of how they were able to find meaning and purpose through their adversity. These are conversations that we have deemed to be difficult, but they don't have to. Together, we can find a shared understanding. This is a podcast for everyone.